It is Friday, September the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, Sudan's economic woes.
The World Bank's Doing Business report ranks Sudan fairly badly at 170 out of 190 countries and territories surveyed.
U.S. inviting China for another round of trade talks.
China is going to play hardball, and maybe the White House has decided that they should sit down and have some serious talks about the issues.
Also ahead, global warming and ocean storms, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir has sworn in a new prime minister in a bid to ease the country's economic crisis. Austerity moves will include a smaller cabinet as that country grapples with an acute foreign exchange shortage and inflation above 65%. Peter Pham is Vice President of Research at the Atlantic Council and Director of its Africa Center. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy about the significance of the reshuffle and what Sudan needs to do to overcome its economic woes.
There are several things. One, it needs a little new energy into it. So I think it sends a signal that they're serious about changing the way they do business. Now, what we have to wait to see is he swore in a new prime minister, Motaz Musa, but he has not yet appointed the new cabinet in its entirety. There were 31 ministers. There will be 21. So there's going to be I think everyone's going to wait to see who remains, who comes, and how the new cabinet will be organized.
The United States has kept Sudan on its list of state sponsors of terrorism despite ending two decades of sanctions in October. Sudanese officials argue that international investors will remain wary of re-engaging in Sudan so long as the country remains on the U.S. terror watch list. Was that the main reason for Sudan's economic crisis?
Well, I think it certainly is not helpful, but most U.S. economic sanctions were removed by President Donald Trump last October. And the fact is, even without those sanctions, which freed up most sectors of the Sudanese economy for investment, it's actually a business decision on the part of many investors not to go into the market. Sudan has a notoriously difficult business environment. The World Bank's Doing Business report, which is an annual report on how easy or hard it is to do business, ranks Sudan fairly badly at 170 out of 190 countries and territories surveyed. So very much near the bottom. It's an ease of doing business, and certainly that makes it difficult to invest. In terms of protecting minority investors, Sudan ranks, according to the World Bank, 186 out of 190. So these are fundamentals that I think even more than sanctions, which preclude investors, and this is what the new cabinet under the new prime minister will need to tackle.
Food prices have more than doubled since last year, causing high inflation rate in Sudan, while the Sudanese pound has plunged against the U.S. dollar. What's really needed to counter the economic crisis in Sudan?
Several things. First and foremost, economic reforms. These are not going to be easy. They're going to be painful, but that's because the economy for such a long time has been distorted. Secondly, the country needs to open up to investors by making itself easier to do business with. I think the business climate, removing economic sanctions was a significant step. Prospectively removing the terrorism sponsor designation will be another step. But even if both those things were done, without the fundamentals being addressed, it remains a problem. Another problem in Sudan is infrastructure. The country's in tremendous need of infrastructure to take advantage of any investors that might come, as well as the possibilities that the building of the Ethiopian Renaissance Dam provides for increased power, increased agriculture in the country, but needs infrastructure. And I think it's very interesting that President Bashir picked the Minister of Water, Irrigation, and Electricity to be the new prime minister.
That is Peter Pham, Vice President of Research at the Atlantic Council and Director of the Africa Center there. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day. You can listen to Encounter following VOA News every Saturday and Sunday, either on the radio or online at voanews.com/encounter. That's Encounter on the Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has accused Russia of seeking to cover up breaches of U.N. sanctions on North Korea. VOA's Steve Miller has more from our bureau in Seoul.
Haley's accusations were made after Moscow pushed for changes to be made to an independent report on sanctions. Last month's UN Security Council North Korea Sanctions Committee report said Pyongyang has not stopped its nuclear and missile programs and is violating UN sanctions on exports. Ambassador Haley accused Moscow after diplomats said Russia pressured the independent sanctions monitors to amend a UN Security Council North Korea Sanctions Committee report. A diplomat speaking on the condition of anonymity told Reuters news agency the amended report removed some references to Russians accused of breaching sanctions on North Korea. The Russian mission and the committee chair did not respond to a request for comment. Steve Miller, VOA News, Seoul.
The Trump administration has invited Chinese officials to another round of trade talks. Larry Kudlow, who heads the White House Economic Council, said Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin sent an invitation to senior Chinese officials, but speaking with reporters offered few details.
Treasury Department is in communication with China. All right. I can't go beyond that. I don't want to get ahead of that curve, but they are in communication with China.
Is that communication different than any previous communication? I mean, they're presumably always in communication with China, right?
I don't know if it's new and different, but I myself think it's a positive thing. I think most of us believe it's better to talk than not to talk. And I think the Chinese government is willing to talk, but I cannot offer any details whatsoever.
But you would
Treasury
like
Secretary Mnuchin's the team leader on this, and you know he's leading that
charge.
Like
to have, you would like to have some more talks with the Chinese.
If they come to the table in a serious way, to generate some positive results. Yes, of course. It's what we've been asking for months and months, what the president's been asking for months and months. Sure, absolutely.
Does it represent a thaw?
I don't want to put adjectives. I don't want to get details. I'm just saying we are in communication right now, and you could say that communication has picked up a notch.
The U.S. has been phasing in tariffs on Chinese imports with a pending announcement of new duties on $200 billion in products, mainly in the tech sector. China has imposed retaliatory penalties on U.S. exports. A new survey in China has revealed that a majority of American companies operating there say the impact of escalating trade tensions is both clear and far-reaching. Steve Hanke, a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University and a former Reagan administration trade official, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the U.S. administration may be rethinking its strategy over the trade deficit.
Perhaps the administration has come to the conclusion that China 2018 is not Japan early 1980s. When the U.S. was muscling Japan around over trade issues, I think the conclusion is that China is going to play hardball, and maybe the White House has decided that they should sit down and have some serious talks about the issues.
This comes as a group called Americans for Free Trade, a conglomeration of some 85 U.S. industry groups, launched this coalition to take their fight publicly over free trade and the issue of tariffs. Is the administration feeling some pressure here at home?
I think they're feeling pressure not only from that group of business leaders, but also from the American Farm Belt. All these people are free traders, and the administration's going against the free trade agenda that these business groups as well as American farmers hold, and so they've got to contend with that. It's not going to go away. It's going to get worse because protectionist policies of the administration are hurting a lot of people in the United States as well as internationally.
The Federal Reserve reported on Wednesday that trade tensions have some U.S. businesses on edge, prompting some to delay or to cut back on planned investments.
It's completely illogical and irrational. I mean, that's what any smart person would do in these circumstances. They tend to keep their powder dry and wait and see what's going to happen, because it's very unpredictable what the course of a trade war would be, and we are actually in a trade war. It's extremely hard to predict the outcomes, but the outcomes are always negative.
At a World Economic Forum gathering in Hanoi on Wednesday, China warned that protectionism threatens global growth and cautioned individual countries, without naming the U.S., against isolationism. Is China on the right side of the argument here?
China's on the right side of the argument, and also I think the geopolitics are related to the new moves by the White House, because China has all of a sudden formed an alliance with Russia and is pushing back against the United States now. You've got Russia and China in league on the trade issue. They're on the same side of the street. The alliances are forming that are pushing back against the Trump administration's protectionist policies.
Steve Hanke, a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Well, weather is big in the news today in the Pacific as well as in the Atlantic. There are two massive ocean storms out there. There are millions of people in their paths. Authorities in the Philippines have begun evacuating thousands of people living in the path of a giant typhoon. And in the eastern United States, the outer bands of a hurricane are beginning to lash the southeastern Atlantic coast as the storm edges closer. It's expected to linger, dumping many centimeters of rain in affected areas and possibly causing widespread destruction. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talks with Tom Knudsen, a climate scientist at the U.S. government's Geophysical and Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, New Jersey, and asks him if global warming is having an impact on these kinds of storms.
We have reason to believe that global warming is making hurricanes and typhoons at least slightly more intense, maybe a few percent more intense than they would be otherwise if humans had not altered climate. But we're not as confident about this effect as we are, say, about the human effect on global temperatures and sea level rise. In other words, the change of intensity of these storms due to human influence is not yet really at a level where we can clearly detect it. So we think it's there based on our model simulations, but it's not a huge effect nor one that we can clearly see in the data like we can for global mean temperature, for example. Human influence from anthropogenic climate warming. So we have higher sea level overall, perhaps 8 inches higher, that order globally. And when you have a hurricane or typhoon coming in with sea level systematically higher than it was in pre-industrial time, that will exacerbate storm surge effects.
It does seem that the pattern has it for the major typhoons. And in the case of Typhoon Mangkhut, as it approaches the Philippines and aims toward Hong Kong, that it is the equivalent of a Category 5 Atlantic hurricane. The typhoons overall seem to be more severe than the hurricanes. Is there anything to that, or is that just an erroneous observation on my part?
There is more activity in general in the Western Pacific than in the Atlantic Basin. I think it's a more conducive basin overall for typhoon or typhoon activity. But we're capable of having very intense storms in all of these basins.
Why do you think it is more active and stronger in the Pacific?
Year upon year, you'll get, on average, more of these tropical cyclones in the western Pacific than you will in the Atlantic. In the Atlantic basin, sometimes you have years where you have relatively cooler sea surface temperatures and high wind shear conditions. You may only just have a handful of tropical storms, maybe even one or two hurricanes in a quiet year. But you won't have a year that quiet in the western Pacific. Even your relatively quiet years there will have more activity.
Is that anything new, or is that always the way it's been?
No, that's basically the way it's been through our historical record. This is not a new development.
Any way you can, I know you can't predict, but can you extend the possibility of what happens in the near future to the Earth as far as these storms are concerned?
We tried to do that using model simulations. What we think is going to happen is the climate's going to continue to warm, sea levels are going to continue to rise. We're not sure how much, the rate of sea level rise, there's some uncertainty in that. But those effects are going to continue and grow stronger. We think that storms are going to become more intense as the climate continues to warm. And the magnitude of that we are currently projecting for late in the 21st century is something like a 4% increase of intensity. And we think that the rainfall rates out of these storms globally are going to increase and continue to increase up to about maybe 10 or 15% greater than they are in the present day. So we think hurricane rainfall rates will increase. We're not sure about the numbers of storms, by the way. The total number of storms may actually decrease. That happens in a lot of our simulations. But we do think that the fraction of storms that actually reach Category 4 and 5, we think that fraction of storms is going to increase as the climate continues to warm.
Tom Knutson is a climate scientist at the U.S. government's Geophysical and Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. That's in Princeton, New Jersey. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This is VOA.
Gemstones, emeralds, and rubies dancing their magic for customers at London's 2018 International Jewelry Show. Milan Mather is the director of Kohinoor Jewelry.
They realize that Indian jewelry has the quality as well, with the kind of cutting and polishing that we have. I mean, it's a different ballgame altogether now.
David Broff is the editor of Jewelry Outlook, and he says the demand for Indian fine jewelry is growing the most.
Euromonitor have just issued a study which says that India is set to overtake the United States as the world's number two fine jewelry market.
Thanks to India's huge population, its rapidly growing middle class, and its growing economy, Mather says India's 74% growth over the past 5 years is only just the beginning in the jewelry industry. But today, at least, China remains the world's number one fine jewelry market, with sales likely to reach $92 billion this year. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Time now for a little something from the world of music.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl. Blacker than night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was deep for this Mexican maiden. I was in love, but in vain I could tell.
Michael Martin Murphy is an American singer-songwriter best known for writing and performing Western music, country music, as well as pop music. A multi-Grammy nominee, Murphy has 6 gold albums, including Cowboy Songs, the first album of cowboy music to achieve gold status since 1959. El Paso is a longtime favorite of people who love cowboy songs.
Down in his hand for the gun that he wore. My challenge was answered in less than a heartbeat. The handsome young stranger lay dead on the floor. Out through the back door of Roses I ran. Out where the horses were tied.
Michael Martin Murphy was born in 1945 in Dallas, Texas. When he was 6 years old, he started riding horses on his grandfather's ranch, and years later he would remember listening to the cowboy songs on the ranch. Family was always very important to Murphy, and as we hear in his duet with Lexi Walker, a singer, songwriter, actress, and recording artist who was just 11 years old when they took to the stage singing What's Forever For.
I've been looking at people, how they change with the time. Lately, all I've been seeing are people throwing love away, losing their minds.
Maybe it's me who's gone crazy, 'cause I can't understand why.
In 1975, Murphy released his seminal album Blue Sky Night Thunder, which included his platinum-certified signature song Wildfire, a sentimental song about the ghost of a woman and her horse. Murphy has had a successful music career that has spanned four decades and included such musical genres as folk, country, rock, popular, western, and cowboy music. As a singer, songwriter, and producer, he's contributed to some of the best-loved songs of his generation. He played a major role in the resurrection of the cowboy song genre, and for his accomplishments in that field, Murphy received 5 awards from the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, formerly known as the National Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City.
She ran calling wildfire. She ran calling wildfire. She ran.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Up next, the latest world news. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Martin Murphy.
For 6 nights in a row, she's coming.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On September 14th, 1812, Napoleon's army invaded Moscow, only to find the city deserted and burning. Failing to achieve a Russian surrender, Napoleon headed back to France in a disastrous retreat that cost the lives of more than 400,000 of his men. At dawn on this day in 1814, during the War of 1812, lawyer Francis Scott Key awoke to see the American flag waving at a distance over Fort McHenry in Maryland. Amazed that the Americans had survived a night of bombardment by British naval forces, Key wrote the words that would become the lyrics for the Star-Spangled Banner, the U.S. national anthem. On this day in 1901, U.S. President William McKinley died of gunshot wounds inflicted by an assassin 8 days earlier. His vice president, 42-year-old Theodore Roosevelt, was sworn in, becoming the youngest president in U.S. history. In 1940, the Selective Service Act was passed by the U.S. Congress. It provided for the first peacetime military draft in U.S. history. President Roosevelt foresaw the need to bolster the military as dangers mounted due to wars in Europe and Asia. In 1948, Gerald Ford beat incumbent Michigan Congressman Bartell J. Junkman in a Republican primary election. The future president went on to win the seat in November. Junkman had become unpopular due to his isolationist position on foreign policy. In 1959, the Soviet probe Luna 2 crashed onto the moon, the first man-made object to reach it. On this date in 1960, Mobutu Sese Seko seized power in Congo, suspending parliament and the constitution. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is VOA News.